failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. My name is Dean Becker. Here in just a moment, we'll bring on our guest for this program. He's the author of A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. His name is Mr. Alfred McCoy. Welcome, Mr. McCoy.
Thank you very much, Dean.
Glad to have you with us, sir. You have spent much of your life investigating the Central Intelligence Agency and its machinations around this planet. Tell us a bit about this new book, if you will, sir.
Sure. What I tried to do was to provide some historical background to the current crisis over torture. In April 2004, when CBS television first broadcast those shocking photos from Abu Ghraib, the initial reaction was best captured, I think, by William Sapphire, writing in the New York Times, when he called the seven accused soldiers, those military police at Abu Ghraib, he called them creeps. Later, I think former Secretary of Defense Schlesinger did an investigation and said basically these are recycled hillbillies on the night shift. And others basically dismissed this as the aberrant acts of a few rotten apples. I looked at those photos and I saw something very different. What I saw was that the prisoners were hooded for sensory disorientation and their arms were extended for self-inflicted pain. And those are the two trademark CIA techniques developed at enormous cost back during the 1950s. Basically what happened was during the darkest days of the Cold War in the early 1950s, the U.S. government was deeply concerned that the Soviet Union had somehow cracked the code of human consciousness, that they had new powerful techniques in the uncharted recesses of the human mind that would allow them to persuade the millions and also to crack individuals. And so the CIA launched a massive mind control project, a veritable Manhattan Project of the Mind, spending up to $1 billion a year from 1950 to 1962. And through this massive research, they discovered a new form of torture, psychological torture. Now, most of us have heard about the most sensational and also least successful aspects of this research, the stories about the CIA doing experimentation with LSD. They ran party houses in San Francisco and New York. They tested LSD unwittingly on CIA employees. One of them jumped to his death from the 10th floor of a New York hotel. These were all exposed in the mid-1970s and have been the subject of a number of books and countless newspaper articles. Well, all this exotic drug research didn't work. What did work was boring behavioral science research outsourced to major universities to discover a new form of psychological torture.
Mr. McCoy, the implementation, the discovery of this process, I think in your book you mentioned it started right after World War II. We took a couple of Nazi experimentation doctors and utilized their services to help bring about this change. Your thoughts on that?
Sure, that's right. We got Dr. Kurt Plotner, who had worked with the Gestapo in several of the death camps and had done things like tested the impact of mescaline and THC on Jews and gypsies. This was all part of the CIA's initial fascination with what we might call exotic techniques. They were convinced that things like hypnosis, truth serum, electroshock, LSD in some exotic combination might actually prove effective interrogation, okay? And so the CIA did almost all of this drug research in-house within the agency, often using agency employees or unwitting victims as unsuspecting subjects. All of this exotic research produced nothing. None of it worked, okay? In any massive scientific research effort, you get negative results. You get dead ends, okay? And they're very rarely reported in the press because they're a failure, okay? We only hear about the successes. But for every success, there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of failed experiments. And all the CIA drug experiments were failed. What worked was the boring, mundane behavioral science research that was outsourced to leading psychology and psychiatry departments at leading at major universities, McGill, Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. The first breakthrough came at McGill University in Canada in the early 1950s when a very famous psychologist named Dr. Donald O. Hebb conducted a series of experiments in which he discovered that he could induce in student volunteers a state akin to psychosis in just 48 hours. Now, what did the doctor do? Hypnosis? Drugs? Electroshock? Truth serum? No, none of the above. All he did was he placed these student volunteers, who were well paid, in comfortable air-conditioned cubicles, and he asked them to wear goggles, gloves, and earmuffs. And deprived of these basic sensations of touch, sight, and sound, they first of all, within a day, had hallucinations, and those who lasted more than a day suffered a breakdown akin to acute psychosis. That was the first major breakthrough. The second major breakthrough was a distinguished neurologist at Cornell University Medical Center in New York City studied on contract for the CIA, the Soviet KGB's torture techniques. And they have found that the most effective of the KGB techniques were not what we might imagine, just raw physical brutality, but instead simply forcing a victim to stand motionless for days at a time as fluids flowed down to the legs, sores formed, those sores erupted in separating wounds, the kidneys shut down, hallucinations took place. And the CIA then took these two techniques, the sensory disorientation discovered at McGill University, and the self-inflicted pain analyzed by Cornell University, and they put them together in 1963 in a curiously titled QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual. And this is basically the CIA's foundational document on interrogation, and is this manual which codifies and articulates a distinctively American form of torture, a revolution in the cruel science of pain, psychological torture.
Well, we are speaking with Al McCoy. He's the author of A Question of Torture. Al, I'm looking at page 90 here, and it has a list of non-coercive techniques, things you were talking about, persistent manipulation of time, serving meals at odd times, disorientation, all these ways to, I guess, break down the mind to manipulate it. And you mentioned this manual put together by the CIA. Is that the same thing that they offer up at the School of the Americas to people from Honduras, Guatemala, in years past, Afghanistan, etc., to train them on U.S. techniques?
It's related. One thing about the CIA paradigm, okay, that it's extraordinarily supple and adaptable. Each protracted application has produced innovation, okay? So, as I said, the CIA codified these techniques. All this elaborate behavioral science research went into that QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual in 1963. Within 3 or 4 years, we found ourselves in Vietnam, where the CIA was assigned the task of breaking the Viet Cong infrastructure, the underground governmental apparatus of the Viet Cong guerrillas whom we were fighting in South Vietnam. And what they did was they established 40 provincial interrogation centers and a national interrogation center, and they applied their new interrogation techniques. But under the conditions of the Vietnam War, these techniques quickly moved beyond their psychological fundamentals to become extraordinarily brutal in their physicality, producing, by the CIA's own count, 20,000 extrajudicial executions. Okay? And then, while this war was raging in South Vietnam, the U.S. Army Intelligence Command set up something called Project X, which I describe in my book, a little-known project that operated for a full quarter century from 1966 up to 1991. And Project X had its mission to transmit the lessons learned in counterinsurgency intelligence, counterintelligence and interrogation from the Vietnam War to Latin America. And as a part of this massive project, what the U.S. Army Intelligence did was, first of all, they produced a complete set of correspondence courses, a complete curriculum involving over 200 courses. In the area of interrogation, they had a three-tier curriculum, kind of interrogation 101, you know, discussions, then they had a seminar, and then they had an advanced practicum, okay? And this was all mailed out to any ally nominated by anywhere in Latin America, ally nominated by a U.S. advisor or diplomat. They translated these manuals into Spanish so that they were readily available. Then they also conducted training sessions. They had U.S. Army mobile training teams, often with CIA officers assigned to them, that moved around Latin America, training officers in place. And then they also brought officers to School of Americas, okay? So it was the if you will, the correspondence course, the mobile training teams, and the School of Americas were all, if you will, subsets, subsidiaries of this larger Project X. And what this did was, this transmitted a form of interrogation that, although founded on the CIA's psychological principles, was actually far more brutal and physical than the original paradigm allowed. And that's where School of Americas fits into this larger story.
Well, no, this whole torture scheme, I suppose you'd call it, has developed over the past approximate 50 years. And quoting from your book, the chapter on the War on Terror, after the attacks of 9/11, the White House made torture its secret weapon in the War of Terror. Tell us more specifically how this paradigm has been instituted or put in place for this War of Terror, the current moment.
Sure. What happened was this. On September 11, 2001, after President Bush finished his public address to a shaken nation, he turned to his top national security advisors and he said to them, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we are going to kick some ass." And then his advisors, White House legal advisors, and the executive branch of the government, including the Secretary of Defense, translated this presidential order into action. This meant, first of all, that a change in who was in control of counterintelligence. Look, from about 1942 up until 2001, the CIA did intelligence abroad, and it was the FBI that had charge of counterintelligence. Counterintelligence in World War II also meant that the FBI controlled Latin America, because this was deemed to be domestically a part of the United States in the realm of counterintelligence rather than intelligence, defensive rather than offensive, okay? So right at the start of the War on Terror, the FBI, as they had during the 1990s, got control of the first al-Qaeda captives. And what happened was is that the White House removed the FBI, fired the FBI from the leadership role in counterintelligence, and transferred the captives and the counterintelligence authority to the CIA. And the reason was very simple. The FBI has not and will not torture. It has very clear guidelines, regulations that agents do not break. Okay, they have a totally different form of interrogation. They practice empathetic interrogation. The CIA tortures, okay? So when the White House wanted to torture, it transferred control over the al-Qaeda captives to the CIA, took them away from the FBI. That was the first move. The second move was a change in Guantanamo. As the suspects were sent in from Afghanistan and elsewhere in the War on Terror to Guantanamo, the initial base commander ran a standard, by the book, military prison, no coercion, regular interrogation, but no really harsh conditions. What happened was, in late 2002, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld replaced this commander, and he installed General Jeffrey Miller with a mission to get information out of those detainees at Guantanamo. And under General Jeffrey Miller, Guantanamo was transformed from a standard military prison into a de facto behavioral science laboratory. And under General Miller's command, the CIA's psychological torture paradigm was perfected. Let me explain. As we discussed earlier, in the 1950s and 1960s, the original CIA form of psychological torture was an attack on universal human sensory receptors, okay? Involving either a denial or a surfeit of sensory stimuli, light and dark, silence and sound, etc. Okay? So everybody's got these sensory receptors, and it's a generally effective technique, believed to be generally effective, to attack those sensory receptors. Now, at Guantanamo, under General Miller, the interrogators took the paradigm one step further. they began to narrow its focus and explore cultural sensitivity. And what they discovered, that dealing with Arab males, that there was, apart from universal sensory receptors, Arab males were psychologically weak through their cultural socialization into matters of gender, sexuality, and fear of dogs. So that you could attack Arab cultural sensitivity by nudity, by simulated sexual acts, by sexual harassment, and by subjecting them to growling dogs. Okay? Then there was a third phase in this research. Now, originally what had happened is research psychologists at the university had participated in the development of the CIA's original psychological torture paradigm. Now what General Milo did was he created what he called Behavioral Science Consultation Teams, BSCT, or BISCT teams. And this meant that trained military psychologists now participated in the actual interrogation of detainees at Guantanamo. And they participated to discover individual fears or phobias, attachment to mother, fear of dark. The net result was that by 2003, certainly by 2004, military interrogators at Guantanamo and CIA interrogators as well had perfected the CIA's psychological paradigm into a total threefold assault on the human psyche. First, attack on sensory receptors, okay? There was still the rock music, the light, the dark, the heat, the cold, all that. Second, an attack on cultural identity, sexual harassment, nudity, use of dogs. And third, the discovery of individual fears and phobias to attack the individual psyche. And it was this method that was transmitted by General Miller in person from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib prison in August and September of 2003, when the insurgency in Iraq, remember, we invaded in March, and then by about July and August, the insurgency was ripping out of control. We found we had no intelligence. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld sent General Miller from Guantanamo to work with General Sanchez in developing new, harsher interrogation techniques to extract intelligence from captives at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq.
We're speaking with Al McCoy, the author of A Question of Torture. Al, I want to ask you, there have been a few people, mostly grunt soldiers in the field, that have been tried and sentenced for sometimes prison stints for their involvement in the tortures in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo. But there's a whole chain of command, you know, from the president down through Rumsfeld, the general, the colonels, the captains, that basically ignored scrutiny. Your thoughts on that?
Sure. First of all, let me explain. In a certain sense, what the military did in transmitting Defense Secretary Rumsfeld's orders for tough interrogation through direct orders, like the ones that General Sanchez issued in September 2003 for methods beyond those allowed in the Army Field Manual 3452, and by indirect signals, okay? But what basically happened is, as these orders percolated their way down the chain of command from the President to the Defense Secretary to Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, etc., all the way down, let's say, into the cell block 1 and 2 at Abu Ghraib, the cell block we've seen in those photos, what happened was is it meant that ordinary soldiers, specialists, and sergeants on the prison floor began to use illegal techniques because they had been instructed to do so. And the techniques are systematic. You look at those photos that are still coming out of grave, and the techniques are repeated. They're always the same thing. It's either short shackling or long shackling for self-inflicted pain. It's hooding for sensory disorientation or deprivation. It's the same thing. It's the standard techniques repeated time and time again. Those are not aberrant acts. So what happened is the soldiers get the methods. They get the orders. They get the methods. They carry out those orders. And then what happens, of course, is the Army Criminal Investigation Command, when the scandal broke, moved in. They investigated these soldiers. They found that, in fact, they had violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They are prosecuted, they are convicted, and they are sent to prison. And it's not just a few soldiers. There are now, I think, over 600 ongoing investigations, and over 100 soldiers have been convicted. And there are many more to come. In a certain sense, it's kind of like a trap, okay? The defense secretary gives orders for illegal torture. Soldiers down the chain of command carry out those orders, and because they're illegal, the Army Criminal Investigation Command investigates them, prosecutes them, and throws them in jail. Now, what hasn't happened yet and what needs to happen is it needs to be tracked up the chain of command carefully, step by step, in order to show where those orders came from. Now, in the trial just this week, which led to the conviction of Sergeant Smith, a dog handler at Abu Ghraib, Colonel Thomas Pappas, who was in command at Abu Ghraib, chief of MPs at Abu Ghraib, Colonel Thomas Pappas testified that the use of dogs was part of instructions and directions given by General Jeffrey Miller to his command in Abu Ghraib. That was when General Miller, in August and September 2003, visited Abu Ghraib on orders of Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and his brief was to Gitmoize Abu Ghraib, effectively to transmit these advanced illegal interrogation techniques from this behavioral laboratory at Guantanamo into the actual cell blocks at Abu Ghraib in Iraq.
Well, okay? Al, we are running out of time. I had one more thought I wanted to discuss.
One last question is, why haven't we investigated General Miller? And then, do you know what happened? There was a Pentagon investigation last summer, and Lieutenant General Randall Schmidt recommended that General Miller be disciplined, but the head of the Southern Command of the U.S. Army overruled that recommendation. And he's tried to retire in good order. That retirement has been blocked by the U.S. Congress, and he will come before Congress, okay? That's the first time anybody's actually begun to examine events higher up the chain of command.
Thank you for that, Al. In closing, it is my perception that it's cognitive dissonance, and that's what perpetuates the drug war, and it seems to be thriving quite well in the war of terror as well. What's your take on the American people, the, if you will, silence of the lambs? What's to be done? Is there a cure for cognitive dissonance?
Unfortunately, yes. That's another aspect of this psychological torture that we use. It is extraordinarily resilient. It's shrouded in all kinds of myths. If you look at the individual techniques, like making somebody stand for a protracted period of time, that doesn't look so bad, okay? In fact, Donald Rumsfeld wrote in a memo once saying, when he was giving orders for General Miller to toughen up at Guantanamo, why are they only standing for 4 hours? I stand all day at my desk, okay? So that's a normal reaction, that this is torture-like. This is not real torture. But when you take the rock music, the heat, the cold, the short shackling, the long shackling, the nudity, yeah, the synergy of these techniques, it winds up being a systematic assault on the human mind, a brutal attack, okay? And yet, we look at the techniques, each one individually in isolation, and think, oh, that's not so bad. And in fact, the rest of the world regards psychological torture as torture, and Americans regard it as torture light, not really torture. And that's the source of the problem.
Very good. We've been speaking with Al McCoy, the author of A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, and it's from the American Empire Project. Thank you, Al.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye now.
Bush drug advisor Robert McGinnis.
We know, for example, that terrorism in many cases is funded by drug sales.
George W. Bush.
If you quit drugs, you join the fight against terror in America.
And now another black perspective on the drug war. The other day, I heard a report on the radio about AIDS orphans in Africa. It said that there are parts of Africa where the AIDS epidemic is so severe that they are awash in a sea of orphan children. So many that they can't possibly care for them all, and a ghastly triage system is used to reserve care for those with the best chance of survival. Children born with the virus live short, hard lives. At least one of these orphanages, the children are taught one of the few skills useful to people who are unlikely to see their 10th birthday. They're taught how to build their own coffins. But children born with AIDS contract the disease at birth, and there is a drug available that can prevent a woman from infecting her newborn child. Now, what should we say when a dying woman asks for help? Not for herself. There's no hope for her, but for her unborn child. A pill that costs just pennies can give her child a chance at life. Black Americans spent $5.2 billion last year getting high. $14 million a day if all black Americans who use drugs declared a week of sobriety and solidarity and pool that money, we could send $100 million to end the suffering of those orphans in Africa. $100 million a week for drugs to make us feel good. But how much better would we feel if we knew that the drugs we were buying were saving innocent lives? For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
On April 23rd, the New York Times published a story by Nicholas Bacalar, Marijuana and a Slower Mind and Body. Quote, long-term heavy users of marijuana perform significantly worse on tests of mental agility and physical dexterity than short-term users or non-users, even when they have abstained from smoking for more than 24 hours, new research shows. At least, so said Mr. Bacalar's story. When I called him, he indicated that I should contact the authors of the study.
If you will, sir, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your work history.
Well, before we do that, let me clarify what this is for. I'm not sure why I'm being interviewed. I don't know why I'm being interviewed. What is this about?
The piece in yesterday's New York Times, Marijuana and a Slower Mind and Body?
Yes.
I see that it came from a study that was in the March issue of Neurology.
I don't know if I'm really the person you should interview. Why don't you interview the person who wrote the study? I'm just another reporter. I mean, why would you want to interview another reporter about a subject that requires some kind of expertise in a medical field? I'd call the expert.
I wonder if you consider the part that you're advancing an idea.
No, you don't understand. I'm not advancing any idea. I'm reporting on someone else's study. That's what I'm doing in that article. That's why I'm confused about this whole, about what you're... Why are you calling me? I'm not an expert on marijuana.
Why would you allow this information to be published as part of Reefer Madness?
I don't know what you're talking about. What is Reefer Madness? I don't even know what you're talking about.
I know I burn my bridges every time I do one of these interviews, but occasionally it's good to glimpse the truth as seen from the other side. This propaganda war continues because these major publications continue to print these novelty stories written by unknowledgeable reporters, self-professed non-experts for a buck. Mr. Bacalar, you are part of that unknowing, uncaring, and highly greedy group known as drug warriors. Whether it's through ignorance, greed, or superstition, you are guilty of promulgating reefer madness.
Okay, I don't like to, I don't know, how shall we put it, pick on other reporters, but the gentleman is putting forward information he knows nothing about for a buck. And I thought it was worth repeating. I want to thank Al McCoy, the author of A Question of Torture, for joining us today. If you get a chance, check out this week's Cultural Baggage Show. Our guest will be Cliff Thornton. He's running for governor in the state of Connecticut. I'm sorry. And he's also going to report on a white paper published by the city of Hartford. They tell me I gotta wrap it up. As always, you guys are the solution. There's no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, no reason for this drug war to exist. We've been duped. The drug lords were on both sides of this equation. Do your part. Prohibido est, doc Evilesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.